Είστε παρέα με το SBS Ελληνικά. Βρείτε περισσότερες ενδιαφέρουσες ιστορίες στο sbs.com.au/greek.
Hello, you're listening to the Greek program of SBS Radio. I'm Dina Gerolimou and we have with us today Maria Dimopoulos, the CEO of the Settlement Council of Australia, who is joining us from Perth. Welcome to the Greek program, Maria, and thank you for making time for us.
Thank you, Dina. I'm a good friend, so I like to participate in these sessions with you.
And we love talking to you because we've known you for such a long time. You're a very well-known social justice advocate, and you gave us your time on a number of occasions throughout the years. Maria, you're not only a daughter of migrants, but a migrant yourself. You came to Australia at a very young age from Greece with your parents, and you experienced firsthand all aspects of settlement and adjustment to a new country. You're perfectly placed to tell us, what is settlement?
Can I just start by saying that when we use the word settlement, Dina, it is important to understand that for First Nations people in this country, settlement conveys a very different experience. So I do want to start by saying that a big part of the conversations that I'm trying to have with migrant and refugee communities in Australia is whilst we might celebrate the journey of settlement and the process of integration, it is really important that we not forget that the story of settlement for First Nations people involves one of dispossession and of trauma, because these lands were never ceded. And so I do want to say that whenever I talk about what is settlement, I want to say that we have to ground that conversation in the point about centering First Nations histories and not forgetting what an absolute privilege it is for those of us who are migrants to this country that we have settled on the lands of the oldest living culture on this earth. So I do want to start by making that point because I do think it's an important one for us to be very cognizant of. What is settlement? I mean, it's not a moment. It's not something that we can measure and say, okay, settlement happens in this many months or years. For me, settlement has to be seen as a journey. It's a process made up of many, many moments, made up of many challenges. But essentially, it's about newly arrived communities trying to connect, trying to build social connections, ensuring that their civic sort of duties and literacy is built, being connected to schools, to employment. Ultimately, though, ensuring that that's done with respect and dignity and an appreciation and understanding of the significance, I think, of contribution to this country, and at the same time ensuring that they are given every opportunity to participate and contribute to this nation.
You mentioned about many moments, many challenges. Mm-hmm. It is a journey. Yes. It's not mm-hmm. something, as you said, that it can be defined as a moment or in a moment.
Yeah.
Why is settlement so important for migrants and refugees?
Well, I think it is essentially the way that we kind of integrate into the host culture, so to speak. For a long time, if we think about settlement policy in this country, I mean, it's not that long ago. You mentioned that I was a migrant to this country myself. It wasn't that long ago that we were expected to assimilate. That idea that somehow you could arrive in this country and erase all connections to what was your pre-arrival experience. We know that that's just not feasible. In fact, it's not desirable. So I'm really pleased that when we talk about settlement now, we talk about settlement as an opportunity for people to feel like they can maintain their sense of identity, that while they do that, they can also contribute to broader intercultural conversations with the multicultural nature of this country. So why is settlement so important? Well, apart from the fact that, of course, it connects us with the basic infrastructure of survival, that thankfully we're now looking at it beyond that. We're appreciating the complexities associated with people's process of acculturation. But as I say, for me, a really important part of the evolution of settlement policy in this country has been the recognition that genuine social cohesion doesn't rely on people's erasure of identity. In fact, it relies on building it, but ensuring that we are engaged in that broader conversation across the many, many aspects of cultural and linguistic diversity that characterises this country.
Maria, since you came to Australia, how has the settlement process and settlement policy, or the settlement approach, if you prefer, changed?
Look, I think about my parents. I mean, as you say, I arrived in this country many years ago, Dina, as a child. And I do recall that there was no access to English language learning. My brother and I basically were situated in this primary school with pillows in hand, can I say, because we were used to having a nap at school in Greece around lunchtime. These things were ridiculed. Our food was ridiculed. I often think about the way in which my parents were spoken to, where there was no respect given for the fact that these were people that brought skills with them. These were people that were struggling to adapt to very new ways of being. There was not a lot of infrastructure. In fact, I'd probably go so far as to say that apart from the social connections that we initiated, that grassroots communities initiated, there was very little. And I'm very proud of that, you know, because I think about the way that our diverse Greek communities, I grew up in Geelong, and of course the Greek community there was very new, but it invested in its people, it invested in those connections. So that's what I call grassroots settlement. Because that's what we did. It wasn't like we had a funded program. But having said all that, migration today is a very, very complex thing. We think about the journey for refugee and humanitarian entrance. We think now how fortunate we are to have a network of services that provide a holistic wraparound response that ensures now that we know what trauma-informed response looks like. We now know the lessons of those that were Greek, Italian, those early migrants. We've learned that we do in fact need to invest in proper infrastructure, because by doing that, we're kind of investing in long-term prevention and long-term commitment to genuine social cohesion.
Maria, you are the CEO of the peak body for settlement in Australia. Now, what is the role exactly of the Settlement Council of Australia?
And Dina, this is my 8th week into the job. Now, even though I've spent
and
three
it would be
decades,
remiss of me not to congratulate yes. you, Maria. But you have
you,
been
Dina.
At the helm of so many peak and important organizations in the social justice, domestic violence, gender equity, indigenous rights, migrant and refugee women rights, that sometimes actually we lose count. Yes, 8 weeks.
8 weeks, but you know, you're right. 3 decades of working in migration policy, human rights issues, and fundamentally committing myself to the work of anti-racism. All of that, obviously, I'm going to bring to this role. But what really excited me and why I put my hand up for a job like this one is that this is an opportunity for a peak body like the Settlement Council of Australia to really grow the network of extraordinary services that are what we describe as settlement services, part of the settlement program that's funded under federal government funding. So I think about the fact that we represent 150-odd organisations, ranging from significant organisations like Settlement Services International or AIMS or other important programs like the Australian Multicultural Resource Centre in Adelaide. This is a national network of services. But the job of the peak body, like any peak body, is to amplify the extraordinary level of innovation, the extraordinary level of dedication and passion that characterises our sector. I want to be able to give voice to this, because one of the things that even in the short 8 weeks I've realised, and why I'm now in Perth undertaking consultations, is often there is this extraordinary work that's being done with grassroots communities, work that really has, in my view, a long-term impact on the way in which this country goes into the next sort of a few decades and centuries beyond us, that often we're not good at singing at the, you know, from the rooftops about the great work that is being done. So what I'm doing as I do this national listening tour from state to state is to listen deeply to the work that's being done, to try and really understand where the gaps of those services are, so that I can go back to government as the peak body and say to a government, and can I say how exciting it is right now that we are so fortunate to have and Minister Anne Ali as the Minister for Multiculturalism, a woman who has lived experience herself, who talks at every opportunity about just how important it is that we provide flat platforms for the voices of those people that are directly affected by this. What a great opportunity for me as a peak body, as the head of a peak body, to now work with that minister, to be able to work with the newly created Office of Multicultural Affairs, to go to government and say, here's the fantastic work that's being done, here's the contribution that's being done, that's being contributed through the economy, through social and health and wellbeing initiatives, but here are the gaps as well. And if we really are serious about social cohesion, then we need to address those gaps. And you know, Dina, I still to this day find that it's the same kinds of issues that present. Issues around politicising migration policy, issues around demonising refugee communities, issues of racism and exclusion. We have to start addressing not only conversations about social cohesion, but really addressing what are the structural barriers to inclusion and equity that prevent people from contributing in the way that I know communities can.
Have you met the Minister, Maria?
I've met her on a couple of occasions.
Since and you can became I say CEO, she, I mean.
Indeed, indeed. Since I, in fact, I've known her for a while, even as an academic, that she did her doctorate here in Perth. But yes, since becoming the CEO, I've had the opportunity to meet her a couple of times now, to hear some of the speeches, to be absolutely heartened when I hear her say social cohesion is not the sole domain of multicultural communities. Social cohesion has to be an intercultural dialogue with mainstream Australia if we are genuinely going to move to a future that represents the Australia that I know we are.
It's been 8 weeks. If you're going to be meeting the government and asking them to address the gaps, what will you be asking?
I'll certainly be asking them in the conversations that they're having right now about, for example, productivity. Now, as you know, the government is working towards a productivity summit. I'm also really pleased to be able to say that SCOA is being invited to these pre-summit discussions, giving organisations like ours that's able to translate in economic and social terms the phenomenal contribution that the settlement sector make to the productivity narratives that I know the government's interested in. They're the kinds of conversations that I'm really pleased that we're being invited to. And I think conversations as we progress around reconciliation, I think the commitment to the Uluru statement should not fall off the agenda. I'm keen again, when I think about future generations, I want to think about our future in this country is one that is genuinely reconciled, where our children can genuinely walk side by side celebrating the ancient cultures of First Nations people. I want to be able to say with confidence that every single newly arrived member of this community has the same equal access to opportunities than anyone else, that ultimately we not only feel like we can contribute, but we can thrive.
You've spoken about your commitment to anti-racism, and what came to mind was the first time I've interviewed you almost 20 years ago. You called upon the large...
I was only 10 then, Dina. You realise that, don't you? I was only 10.
So 20 years ago, you called upon the large established communities like the Greek community to assist and support the new and emerging communities of migrants and refugees. If I recall, you were working with the African community back then, and you actually cautioned in that interview against complicity to racism, hatred, and division. How do you see the role of the established communities towards social cohesion today?
And you know, the message still stands today. I would reiterate the points about resisting the particularly some of the negative media that seeks to divide us. I mean, this is functional hatred. That's what I call it. It serves a purpose. Dividing communities simply undermines our ability to actually engage across our differences and diversity. Look, as I said, in travelling around the country, I see wonderful, inspiring examples of more established communities lending a hand, of providing input through mentoring programs. Because, you know, Dina, and you would know this better than most, we experience this as migrants at a deeply visceral level. We know what the impact of being excluded is. We know what it feels like at that deeply visceral level. Why would we not see it as an accountability of ours, as a commitment of ours to making sure that those that come ahead of us, that those that are coming in now, get a better deal because of the work that we do? So I absolutely think it's incumbent on older established communities to be able to step up, to offer those insights and learning, to lend a hand to newly arrived communities, to support the establishment of their organisations and associations so that they too can contribute as successfully as the Greek community, for example, has done. And I see examples of that. And that really does inspire me. I mean that very genuinely. At the same time, though, with technology as it is and the potential for misinformation to wreak havoc, I also caution that same point that I made all those years ago. Let's resist those messages that are based on misinformation, that are based on orchestrated hatred, because I think that is not the pathway to genuine embracing of diversity and inclusion in this country.
So you see the role of the established communities as one of identifying the new face, the new forms of hatred and racism, and speaking out?
Absolutely. And you say new forms. I think the manifestation of that is important. You know, you've touched on a very sensitive issue for me. One of the things that increasingly I'm finding that people are saying is, look, do you identify with being white? Now, I have to say that whilst I recognise the privilege that comes from the proximity to whiteness, I recognise that I'm a Greek Orthodox, white passing person. I now have privilege, thanks to my parents and Gough Whitlam. I emerged from Monash University with a law degree that cost me nothing. Bring back free education, I say. I recognise all that privilege. And with that privilege comes a deep responsibility, and one that I hope I've really embraced and taken forward in the work that I do around human rights and really challenging discrimination and inequality. But at the same time, I am not white. Those experiences that have shaped me as a migrant, those very early years of experiencing racism directed at me, that experience of having to learn English by reading books, self-taught entirely in the schoolyard, those experiences have, in essence, formed my beliefs about the rights of all people, irrespective of backgrounds, to be able to demand and receive respect and equality of treatment. So it is an interesting conversation. I do recognise that migration is a very different experience. I recognise the very unique impact of coming to this country as a refugee and all that comes with that. So, yes, it is important that our responses are informed by those very unique experiences and take into account the significance of trauma, pre-arrival trauma. At the same time, though, I do reject this idea that somehow that experience that I had as a child growing up is now irrelevant. For me, it provides a very rich source of learning. And as I say, I've chosen to now take the privilege that's come from that investment of extraordinary sacrifice on the part of my parents and my communities. I've chosen to use that now as a platform to promote the rights of those most newly arrived. And I also acknowledge there is something very real about racism directed towards Asian Australians, African Australians, and of course First Nations Australians. But let's join together and collaborate around those points. Let's not lose sight of the important idea of solidarity across our difference.
Maria, you've been working in the multicultural, social justice, gender equity, as we were saying before, space for decades. You've been a very strong voice in the domestic violence space from the very, very early days of your career as a lawyer. You've written papers, submissions, presentations. You've given speeches in Australia and abroad. You've represented Australia in the international fora on a number of occasions. You've even marched numerous times demanding justice for victims of domestic violence and victim survivors. Why is this problem still persisting?
Oh, my goodness. What a very significant and important question that you asked, Dina. And in fact, last week I attended on behalf of the Settlement Council of Australia a national roundtable that was convened by the National Domestic Violence and Sexual Violence Commissioner, along with Minister Tanya Plibersek and Assistant Minister for the Prevention of Violence, Jed Carney. So here we are again. In 2008, I was appointed by the then Rudd Gillard government, in fact by Tanya Plibersek herself, to the National Council to Reduce Violence Against Women. And I still recall very vividly the hope that we had when the government, the then government, announced a national 10-year action plan aimed at the reduction and eventual elimination of violence against women and children in this country. Here we are in 2025, and we are in many ways still having the same conversations. Yes, things have changed, and not for one moment do I want to diminish the significance of legislative change, of attitudinal change, of the kind of investment that governments and grassroots communities have made towards the eradication of violence. But in my view, that perhaps what is still missing is that intersectional lens that asks the questions through the lens of diversity and says, look, are the models that we've been using, are the models enough? Do the models actually speak to that diversity of community? And I think that that is perhaps the bigger conversation. Are we engaging our multicultural communities in ways that recognises and places at the centre of the current thinking their experiences, their understanding? You know, collectivism, I think, that frames so many of our communities hasn't been adequately understood as a source of strength. Often culture is presented, in my view, through negative discourse. We've got to stop that deficit dialogue when we think about migrant and refugee communities and start seeing faith and culture as a source of strength, as an opportunity to try and look at more innovative ways of prevention strategies in our communities. Look, even as I speak, sadly, only a week ago, yet another woman lost her life to family and domestic violence. This is unacceptable. We cannot tolerate this any longer. It is heartening to see the government step up again, but we need a lot more investment in that prevention, and prevention that I think properly takes into account the diversity of experiences and understanding across this nation, because I think that there is great insight that can be offered by many of these grassroots communities that on a daily basis are resisting this violence. It's only when together we say no that we can stop this violence. You know, I still really get emotional, Dina, because one of the first projects, and you'll remember this, as a young, you know, law graduate really, was the Women's Coalition Against Family Violence. And at the time, this was, you know, 1995, we were documenting the loss of lives of women and children at the hands of men that supposedly were supposed to, you know, love and protect them. Sadly, that figure is worse. So we absolutely need to collectively look at this issue and say enough is enough. And we need to resist, I think, the erosion of these important, hard-fought rights. I was at the Commission of the Status of Women earlier this year because I also am the chair of Safe and Equal, a peak representative of Specialist Family Violence Services here in Victoria. So I attended the Global Commission on the Status of Women at the UN in New York in March this year. And, you know, it horrified me that there was an opening address by some governments, I won't name who, but governments who came in and basically said things like, women need protection, not equality. It stuns me that now in 2025, when we thought we had won rights where we'd won a certain degree of understanding that the right to be free from violence is an absolute non-negotiable human right, that we are still having conversations about the rights of women to live in safe environments.
Can you summarize the three main points that are responsible for this problem still persisting? You mentioned the models. It's not clear to me what models are you referring to.
Yeah. I think that we still tend to use monocultural models, models that are based on dominant Western ideas about how to address these issues. I think that's changing. I think we are starting to accept that a one-size-fits-all isn't the way to address family violence. I think we are recognising that there is value in going back out to some of our diverse communities and asking them, you know, co-designing with them, looking at champions in our communities who are doing the work. How can we collaborate more closely with that interface? Those grassroots communities often have solutions, and yet we tend to infantilise or diminish the value of those solutions. That's probably the key thing. The other thing that I want to say is that this isn't an individualized response. While certainly we can develop behavior change programs and that they're much required, I'm not suggesting they're not, but we have to start understanding that these are systems-wide problems that require system-wide responses. These are attitudes that are embedded across every aspect of our society. And until we understand just how widespread that is, how important it is that we are addressing prevention messages from day one, children in primary school, right through to adult or political leaders right now. And finally, to say that that human rights lens, that recognition that every single human has the right to live and thrive in a violence-free environment in order to reach their full potential. We cannot lose sight of the human rights frameworks, and sometimes I see that being diminished.
Maria, we can talk for many hours about women's rights and Indigenous rights and social justice, because you are a wealth of information and you have decades-long experience. But we need to wrap it up here. Thank you very much for your time today. Wishing you all the best in your new role as the CEO of the Settlement Council of Australia, and looking forward having you again on our program to discuss more about these issues.
Dina, can I also say my gratitude to you over such a long time, because it is the leadership of women like you in media where you are constantly creating opportunities and platforms for these messages to get through. Without that, really, we'd be talking to each other. You offer such critical, significant opportunities where our message gets out. And I, for one, and I know this is echoed by so many other sisters and brothers out there, that the value of you is just extraordinary. So thank you to you. More strength to you, sister, and looking forward to that coffee or perhaps even an ouzo at some point in the future.
Looking forward to that, Maria. I will hold you to it. Thank you very much again.
Κάντε like, μοιραστείτε, σχολιάστε, ακολουθήστε μας στο Facebook, στο SBS Greek.